Welcome to Body Matters Podcast, where we bring to you raw and inspiring content on all things to do with body positivity and eating disorder recovery.
But before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as traditional people and traditional owners of this country. We acknowledge with gratitude First Nations communities for their continuing care and connection to the lands or waters with which they have protected for thousands of years. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and recognize that First Nations sovereignty was never ceded.
On this week's episode, I am super excited to be introducing you to our next special guests, non-diet dietitians, Meg McClintock and Susan Williams. Meg and Susan have joined together as non-diet dietitians to make a positive change in the area of media literacy, body image, health, and nutrition, where Meg and Susan have founded the organization Meg and Susan. On this week's episode, we will be speaking about eating disorders, disordered eating, body image, and diet culture across the age spectrum, discussing various life stages from having a child, having babies, to becoming a grandparent, discussing how all ages are exposed to diet culture and marketing aimed at our bodies. So, to talk a little bit more about it, here is Meg and Susan. Thank you so much, Meg and Susan, for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you for having us.
Would you be able to provide a little background information about yourself for the listeners?
All right.
Yeah, sure. Sure. So we have similar backgrounds.
She's Meg McClintock.
Oh, I'm Meg, this voice. And so we are both dietitians working in the eating disorder space. We both have our own individual private practices where we do individual clients, but also supervision of other dietitians. So mine is called Choose Nutrition and Susan's is Zest Nutrition Consulting. And about a year and a half ago,
we're
just chatting and trying to get to that point of wanting to have a bigger impact, because there's only so many hours in the day. And as much as we love our one-on-one work and our supervision work, we want to get ahead of it, do a bit more prevention work, and just sort of be able to reach more people. So that's why we decided to team up as Meg and Susan and do some online courses, start our podcast, start doing some stuff, some like free resources, but also some paid courses to
really try to name Meg and Susan.
That's where we ended up.
So we couldn't think of anything better.
No, there were some terrible options in between.
So we've done a bit of work together before. We both do a lecture every year at Wollongong Uni to dietetic students on like a health at every size approach or
a non-diet
approach. And we've also, oddly, done some catering together for a colleague of ours who's a psychologist who has run a few retreats. And she was trying to find some like non-diet catering people. And we were like, oh, we can do that. So we knew we could sort of work together under pressure. And so that's how we're here today, I guess.
That's so fun. What type of foods would you bring to the retreat?
Oh, well,
we did everything. So we were staying on site and doing six meals a day.
Breakfast, morning tea, lunch, afternoon tea, dinner and dessert. And we really specifically made it we wanted to make it like that family style. So, right, you know, plenty of food. Help yourself, like sort of go back, get more, try things.
Well, all foods fit. All in the hierarchy of food.
So, there were a whole lot of people doing a sort of diet recovery program. And so we really wanted to, you know, we genuinely, when we, the first retreat, we thought we were just cooking, right?
Mm.
We did not think at all that it's like, actually, this is really part of people's, like the part of the process. Cause you know, living that, like turning up, making a choice, looking at the food, like, oh, that's delicious, I'm going to have some more, or, oh, I don't really like that, that's, and being able to leave.
So we're
being with people.
Yeah. So we tried to do as much as possible, sort of build your own plate from all of these options. But for people who weren't quite there yet, there we were able to provide a bit of guidance about what flavor's going to work together, what sort of, you know, sort of, you know, that there is something to be said around the balance of nutrients. Let's make sure there's some carbohydrate and some protein and some fat. So it was really fun.
So the first one too that we did, there were a few people with celiac disease. So we were making cakes. So cakes were like our sort of morning tea every day. And so of course, because they needed to be gluten-free. So we just there was lots of like ground almonds. And so it was like during one of the meals that somebody said, "Oh, you guys have redeemed almonds." Also, for
we
me.
Used almonds as a topping on a rice dish that we did. And we had them in the muesli. We made like a homemade muesli that had almonds in it. Yeah. And we just realized that, and that's partly why we got to the name of our podcast, like Life's Too Short to Count Almonds. It's because almonds just became such a diety thing for people, you know, eat.
So then there was this comparison around the table about how many you'd been allowed to have by your dietitian or your whoever that you'd seen. And people would just, everyone had a different number.
Allowed 12, I was only allowed 8, 15.
Like, it was mad.
So funny. It's absolutely mad. But it's just this so clear how food that can just be delicious and nourishing and wonderful can just be ruined by diet culture.
So problematic for people, but it was really good fun. Hardest work we've ever done in our lives.
We slept very well.
But good fun.
I didn't know that almonds were a common theme in like dietetics, like what's kind of prescribed.
When was it? Was it the 90s or early 2000s? There was this moment in time where not just dietitians, but probably personal trainers. There was this real theme about
if you're hungry,
just grab it like a handful of almonds.
And
like,
then it was the almond mum thing.
The almond mum. That's right. Yeah.
Eat a couple of almonds if you're hungry, which is not going to solve anyone's hunger. And it was sort of became sort of emblem of diet culture in the home is to have like an almond mum. And so
it's like
surprised of how many people on retreat had that experience with almonds. And then like it was 4 years later that the almond mum thing came out. We're like, oh, this is universal.
Yeah. And I know. Poor almonds.
Poor almonds. They're great.
They're delicious.
So good.
And there's so many things you can do with almonds rather than just having them themselves.
And often the recommendation was to have them raw.
Yeah, the worst kind of almonds.
No salt, not toasted.
Yeah.
The worst almonds.
So we were sort of like, we just had this like round the clock sort of almost live-in experience with people.
What is non-diet nutrition?
Yeah,
like?
It was great. Mm-hmm. But the thing we really noticed, and you know, with our dietitian hats on, was as the week went on and people became more and more and more comfortable actually, you know, choosing food to meet their needs, people's nutrition improved, like, you know.
From a quality and a variety.
So people were like, oh, we can make this delicious. Mm. All right, well, I'm happy to eat broccoli now. Like, so, yeah, it was really interesting. And it just, you know, it proves sort of like what we know. Like when we make food the enemy and feared and all about like calories, it actually ruins
a lot of
people's variety, decreases their nutritional balance, is poorer, so we end up like creating the exact opposite thing that we're trying to do.
And to hear the non-diet approach from dietitians as well would make people feel more comfortable and trusting of that intuitive approach, you know, pick different foods that they want, see how they're feeling, the social
rebuilding body trust, all of that. Yeah.
It's going to help. But we do want to ask our guests about self-care. So I thought I'd ask you both about some self-care that you both like doing.
Sure. So I think cooking for both of us, that's probably similar. So I like cooking. As much as it's boring, meal planning. Like actually sitting down on the weekend and going, what's in the freezer? Where am I shopping? what are we eating for this week?
Taking care of future me.
Yes. Yeah. Is actually really boring self-care. And for me, social movement. So I most mornings of the week get up and either go for a walk or a run or a swim with friends. And that just sets my whole week lovely in motion. I get a little chat, a little bit of endorphins.
Yeah.
And it helps me go to bed at a reasonable time too. Because when I'm not doing it, I'll be fine on 6 hours sleep.
No.
Fine. So yeah, those are probably the ones for me.
I've from a movement point of view, I've recently started doing like reformer Pilates, and I did not think I'd like it, and I really like it. I was really surprised. I'd never really been much of a regular movement participant up until probably like my late 30s. I don't know. I had this real story about being unco and whatever. So that's great. In the last 10 years or so, I've been much more into like physical activity. But again, social.
Yeah,
I would probably do anything. Social. I've done the dumbest, weirdest, long distance, stupid stuff with a group of friends. So as long as I can, have a chat and a laugh, that's a big part. But what else? I've scheduled my haircut with a friend. So once every 4 weeks, we sit there and have a rah, rah, rah. But the bubble bath and the massage thing, that's not really it.
No.
It's probably like the daily stuff that actually sometimes feels a bit like, ugh, but after you've done it, you feel good.
And it seems you like the social stuff. It's amazing that you're able to book in your hair appointment at the same time.
I know. Well,
you like your hair there.
I feel like it's something that, a bit like, we talk about movement all the time, and in some of the same ways we talk about food, like, that it's, punishing, and it's all about like body control and like my own personal insight on what actually gets me moving is I have no interest in being competitive. Like that doesn't do it for me at all. For some people, that's going to be that's going to be a real, meeting their, achieving their personal bests and beating their previous records. And that's going to be their thing. My thing, I absolutely know 100% is, being sociable and social and having a chat.
And I've had stages of being more, hey, I've signed up for this event and I'm getting faster. I want to hit a certain number on parkrun or whatever. But even so, it's all social.
I would not
have done half the things that I've done if I wasn't training with a big group. It was kind of like a personal achievement.
Fear of humiliation will get me. I just don't want to be the person that they go, okay, lady, get in the van. You're off the track. that'll do it too. But yeah, I don't think I've signed up for anything ever by myself. So yeah, the social side of things, that's big for me.
Yeah, it makes a difference. So like, let's say something's hard for you and it's hard for others, then you feel more encouraged to just keep going rather than, other people experience the same things and you just keep going.
Yeah, like my husband is completely the opposite. He is completely intrinsically motivated. He will just do exercise
for himself.
Because it, whatever. But like that is just not me. And I think often we, same sort of thing with food movement, there's like we almost pitch that there's a right way. And if you're not doing it for yourself, you're not doing it properly. And
you're not getting better all the time.
Yeah. Actually it just feels really, I feel better. I sleep better. But go to the doctor regularly, get things checked on.
We did a whole episode on boring self-care about 6 months ago.
Take things as prescribed.
Get back on your own supplements, Meg.
Drink the stupid water. Just do the thing. So yeah.
And valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess today we are going to be speaking about eating disorders across the age spectrum. So I guess how might they present differently across the age?
So we've both worked with people from quite early childhood through to quite old age. What were you saying?
I think my youngest client ever experienced an eating disorder would have been 7 or 8.
Same.
And then my I guess current sort of older clients are in their 60s.
Yeah.
But I did some work in aged care, in like residential aged care homes, and you know, you get the referral because someone's lost weight because they've been sick, and you go in and they're like, oh, good, I've lost weight. And you're like, okay, Betty, who's 94, this is not good.
we don't want this. Yeah.
I was
a bit of very random hospital, private hospital consultation. So, you know, if they've got somebody in on a tube feed, and I definitely remember one quite elderly lady, you know, looking at the bag of the feed and dialing down the rate of the feed to manage, like, she's so unwell that she's in hospital and she's being fed, you know, with, you know, not orally, and yet she's still managing her calorie intake by, you know, and like, you just go, wow. That, and that's probably one of the conversations I would have one-on-one with people, especially when you're, you know, working with adolescents or their families. Like, this doesn't just go away.
Yeah.
You, this is really, we've got to really, you know, got to knock this on the head now. We've got to kick it out
the door. Because it's slam and lock the door.
It doesn't just go away.
On its own, no. You don't just grow out of it. It's not something, it's not about immaturity. It's not about intelligence. It's a, you know, a really significant mental condition that needs proper treatment.
And it's meeting a need right now, you know, like it's functional in a way, like it's serving a purpose. So let's look at it like that. And let's like work out how do we not need this anymore? So I guess, how do they present? Like, in a way they present the same way, but we don't necessarily see it. I think, like, we have this picture in our head of eating disorders being a young, thin, white
14, 15 girl,
you know, and so, like, almost everybody outside of that, if they're in a larger body, if they're older, if they're, you know, different gender, if like, we just often don't see it. And, you know, postmenopausal, perimenopausal, postpartum, like, we're, the same things are happening. You know, restriction or binging or purging or overexercise or whatever, they're there, but often they're validated or they're congratulated. So, yeah.
And that's so crazy that you were talking about before, that older lady and like the 94-year-old, like how diet culture has influenced them so much. But when you get older, if you're losing weight, losing muscle, like you're unable to recover, like from injuries, from illness, like it's a really big issue that, you know, it causes more risks to your life when you're older.
Absolutely.
When it happens, like that's a warning sign if you're losing a lot of weight, that there's, you know,
something's
wrong.
Well, the other thing too is, like, when we look at, say, the, you know, the BMI charts, what we know is that it's quite normal for adults to be gaining weight across the lifespan, because across like adulthood, until a point when they actually do start to lose weight. So, you know, like, we often talk about like this, like, weight gain as if it's a problem and it's not normal, and we should all be like the same weight that we were like at 18 or something, you know, pick a point. But we know that, like, there's some survival benefit in that. Like, if we are coming into our very old age from a heavier point, we're probably going to have stronger bones, but we've got some buffer.
Yeah,
you know,
and so both Susan and I, we don't, you know, we don't sort of use BMI ranges to in our practices. We, you know, we're sort of quite weight inclusive, but still, with people who do, the like healthy weight range, lots of inverted commas here, once you're over 65, does increase by a couple of points. Like, it is not just, you know, it's expected, and it is actually, you know, when we look at relative risk, it's actually better. But it's, you know, if you look at any of the social media, particularly this on our podcast before, Facebook must have realized that I'm like in my early 40s, and all the ads are for all around sort of perimenopause and the weight gain and stop the weight gain. Oh, isn't it terrible, the weight? And I'm like, oh my goodness, like, if it's happening like to everyone, maybe it's not pathological. But we've got this study that any weight change up at any time in your life, except for pregnancy, is wrong and bad and it shouldn't happen. So the risk factors are, I think we do see these clusters of increased risk at those times where bodies are changing. So you, of course, like the adolescence, pregnancy and postpartum, and perimenopause and menopause are often where we might see sort of clusters. But there's just this noise, this constant onslaught of don't lose control. Are you managing weight? What are you doing with your weight? Keep your weight under control.
That you've always got to have this flat stomach. You know, always. Like the term menobelly is rife. Don't worry, it'll come to you. It's fine. You're not in that age category yet. The algorithm will change for you too. But it's, yeah, it's relentless and it's quite.
And it will send people to quite extreme restriction, which if they've got a genetic predisposition for an eating disorder, could trigger that eating disorder, even if it is the first time that's happened in their life, or re-trigger something that they experienced in their adolescence or in their early 30s or whatever. And so we do see a re-emergence. Sometimes when we have clients who are coming to us for disordered eating or eating disorders who are in the sort of, you know, 50 and above, do have that history of, oh, actually I had problems with this when I was at school.
When I was a teenager.
When I was a teenager. Yeah. Very common, but it's not all the time. Some people's like, this is new. They feel like it started as a healthy lifestyle choice.
Yeah.
And it just got away.
It took off
because it has sort of turned on that genetic predisposition. You know, they've had the gun loaded by our culture, and then that diet or that restriction has pulled the trigger on
that. And the thing is, particularly for women in like perimenopause, there are some biochemical changes, like, you know, like the reduction in estrogen, you see change in abdominal circumference, really natural and normal, increases in cholesterol, really sort of like to be expected, but it's the hormonal change. But you've got the hormonal change, you also see weight change and blood, you know, fats change. And so the advice people get is drop your weight to fix your cholesterol. It's like the thing that's actually causing both of those things is a hormonal change. So, you know, some people will do like different things. They might use hormone replacement, or what do they call it now? Menopause hormonal treatment, MHT, I think it is. And that actually will help manage those changes in cholesterol. It may not do anything about the weight though. But yeah, like we look at this, we make this correlation all the time between weight and something else, fix that and this thing will fix. But it's not a false line. Yeah. We're linking two things that are linked differently. So it's that's probably a risk as well. In we're trying to actually reduce people's cardiovascular risk, but perhaps we're pushing them towards problematic dieting or exercise behavior. So
yeah,
fun times.
And I guess you guys were talking about the different kind of stages that happen in life, like menopause. I guess how might your diet actually kind of change within different periods and your appetite and things like that?
Yeah, well, I think you look at, so if we start right back, like childhood, like leading into adolescence, like what we expect children's bodies to change from and to, like, so across adolescence, we're expecting, you know, 15 to 20 kilos weight change at least, you know, and that's completely normal. And kids' growth is weird. Like they go out, they go up, you know, feet grow, but like, you know, like it's chaos. And like I've said to my children, like things are going to get strange. Just sort of just
hold on. That's the process.
You will come through the other side and it'll be okay. Keep showering, keep eating, sleeping, drinking, hanging out with your mates, look after yourself. It's going to be okay. I'm here. But it's weird. And if you know it's weird, you can sort of maybe ride it out. But the appetites are chaotic as well, you know, like they're powering through everything and then it slows right down and then they're off again. So
and then unfortunately what then comes in particularly for girls. You know, with boys, I've got three boys. Susan has three girls.
We're the brave bunch.
When people hear I have three boys, they're like, how are you going to afford to feed them over adolescents? They're going to be eating everything. They're going to follow things. And it's true. They're going to have like, they're going to be in heaps. But so are the girls. And so the boys will be like, oh, you're growing. This is so good. Fuel up. Get all the nutrition in.
Lucky they know how to make pancakes.
Like all of that. Whereas the girls who are having the same growth rates, who have the same increase in hunger, were like, oh, should you be eating that?
Be careful. Not my girls.
Not yours. But that's we often hear this from our clients who at that point are taken off to Weight Watchers.
We glory in boys' appetites. Mm. We're like, oh, you know, but we're a little bit worried when it's a girl. So there's definitely pressure.
Yeah, absolutely. Which can then again trigger those controlling behaviors, which for someone who's genetically predisposed is, you know, could certainly send them right off into a full eating disorder. And we're not just obviously talking about anorexia and bulimia, but also binge eating disorder, which is much more common.
And disordered eating, you know, that's a misery as well, you know? So then you've got like, you know, pregnancy, I suppose, is another time. Oh gosh, what about weddings? You know, people talk about shredding for the wedding.
Yeah.
What a nightmare.
Yes.
Way to ruin like a really cool day.
And fun time.
Oh, I know. And then look back at those photos forever and be miserable. Like you had no responsibilities, no children, all the it's time in the massive world. Massive
motivation.
Huge motivation. Yeah. Awful. But, you know, you're an adult and probably not really a lot is going on with your, you know, that's sort of chaotic really about your requirements. But going into pregnancy, you know, we get like really, really unhelpful advice, you know.
And it can be quite interesting. So I've worked with clients who have been experiencing like really significant restrictive eating disorder, anorexia in particular, pre-pregnancy and for pregnant. And at some point in their recovery, they were to get their period back and then it's incredibly protective for them for a while. They're actually, because they are so other person centered or so concerned and they wanted, you know, they want to look after this baby they're growing through that time of pregnancy, they're able to overcome their like drive to restriction.
Can you know, though?
Not always.
Not always. And that can
sometimes
be
the weight gain.
There can be so much shame.
That's right. So that time can be protective or can be, you know, even harder. But for the people for whom it was protective, once they're perhaps no longer breastfeeding, it can come back with a vengeance.
Yeah.
And so we're doing a lot of work in that positive time while their brain is nourished and they've got a bit more flexibility to be really working hard with their psychologist to prepare them for when that motivator won't be there. What are we hanging on to? Like where are our values? What do we want the future to look like? But it's modeling for the child, but also just for your own life.
Yeah.
So that's obviously quite different. Like when pregnancy and postnatally is quite different in that, you know, in the work that we're doing, because it's a bit time limited.
Yeah.
And
it can be a really empowering time where you're like, oh, my body has really, really got this. Like
even under all of that, look how it's gonna go.
It's, you know, but it can actually, even if you haven't had an eating disorder, if you've been quite conscious about, you know, managing weight, shape and size, pregnancy is a time where your body really does go, right, I've actually got this. You will be eating now. Actually, you'll be sleeping now. That first trimester is quite bizarre. It's like jet lag and
it's like primal hunger.
Oh my goodness. It can be really, really distressing because it's like I can't actually resist this hunger. This is different than anything I've ever experienced in my life.
Mm.
And I can't exercise because I need to lie down flat because I'm nauseated. And so it can be really, it can go either way.
Mm.
But also you get some of these really black and white guidance of, you know, you only need this many extra calories because you're da-da-da-da-da. Well, you know, like you've then perhaps got that advice that you're trying to stick to and then you've got this primal hunger.
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't stand in front of me or otherwise I will eat you. Get out of the way. And then, you know, then you're apparently breaking some sort of rule.
Yeah.
But also we've got like, there is quite a bit of weight guidance, like how much weight should you gain? And if you're in a smaller body, you should gain more than if you're in a larger body, which is so counterintuitive, I think. And so it can be a really difficult time where people are being weighed a lot, you know, and that can be really, really tricky. So there's some like probably red flags for people who've maybe had some difficulties going into pregnancy. How are you going to manage this scrutiny on your body?
And what's fascinating is the difference. So some obstetricians don't weigh their patients the entire pregnancy, and then some other clinics, it's every single time, just in the hallway with everyone watching, and then the number, like, it's so, again, for people who do have that history of like having a really fraught relationship with the number, actually doing a lot of work
manage that. I think some of the like some of the genuine food safety sort of guidelines that you need to follow can be a bit sort of tricky. So, you know, you're trying to avoid like listeria, and so that can increase some food anxiety. So it's, there's lots of vulnerability, I think, in that time. And then, you know, but the other thing too is like after that, then you're feeding a baby and watching their innate appetite.
Yeah.
So that can be like, that can be a moment. And that's where we often find we work with mums who go, oh, I've got some stuff.
Yeah. I'm not going to know how to keep feeding you as you grow.
I need to sort my stuff out because I cannot pass it on. You know, there's this, like, they're seeing this baby completely responding to its appetite, and like they're done, they're not interested, they don't want any more food. You can't force feed a breastfed baby, like, you just can't, it doesn't work. And there's the mum's just like going, so this is interesting.
But then at the same time, because nothing is simple, the messages around losing the baby weight.
Overwhelming.
And so that can be such a harmful place to be, because again, the algorithm's going to know, oh, you've been looking at cots and prams and this, so we know that you're in that age group and you've just had a baby or you're close to it, and so your social media feeds are going to be full of this program, that program, this, like all of this stuff to try to lose the baby weight, which is again just dieting and just, you know, on that spectrum, like dieting to disordered eating to an eating disorder, it's all pretty gray. And so it's a really risky, I think. Well, and again, it's been experienced with the class I've had.
Yeah.
Postpartum did seem to be a higher risk stage, because there's also, you focus on the baby and caring for the baby. It's really easy to not do the self-care for yourself. It's really easy to not eat enough. It's really easy to not, you know.
Yeah.
And so that then can be a risk in itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
So get help. I guess our thing is, you know, like there are people who would, you know, who can absolutely help people.
Then you might have a few like years where things are pretty steady and stable. You know. But like pregnancy is, everything's about growth, you know, and so you do have this huge hormonal change that is all about, you know, retaining as much of the energy that you consume as possible to grow a whole human and their whole nervous system and their whole blood supply, everything, their whole body, and then, you know, feed it afterwards. So like some people will have, you know, a particular experience in a first pregnancy and then a very different experience in a second pregnancy or subsequent pregnancy. And so, you know, there can be multiple periods of vulnerability where people are like, right, now I need to get back down to where I was.
Mm.
People who are trying to maybe access IVF who are in a larger body, you know, and there's like a weight cutoff, there's just, you know, pressure all over the place, or they might not be able to deliver in their own local hospital if they are, you know, if their BMI is over a certain number. So there's lots of ways that pressure for like weight loss and body sort of control can come in. And it's sort of not just the pressure from, you know, people selling programs on social media. So again, your body's been through a massive upheaval, and then you're getting messages about, well, now you need to do this with it. Mm. So it's Yeah, it can be a really, I think, just a support around people, and messages mm-hmm. about your body actually being trustworthy are really probably quite mm-hmm. helpful. And then, yeah, that next big stage when it all starts to switch off.
Bye-bye hormones. So,
perimenopause, you know, and you know, you were saying before about like your nutrition requirements, and you might find that foods actually do sort of sit differently and feel different, and the way, you know, like foods you've previously sort of enjoyed might just not be, you know,
sit right anymore.
Yeah, you know, and like your digestion changes and you're feeling a bit bloated or a bit sort of, yeah. So it's,
and your routine, because I think for a lot of people as well, if you like, if you've had a routine that's been kind of scaffolded by your work of, you get to work at this time and you have work at this time, you have actually, if that's just suddenly gone because you're retired or you're doing different things, again, it's really easy to miss that self-care, mm-hmm. miss that regular eating, and if you're not particularly connected to your body cues as well.
I think too, like the last couple of years of people doing work from home as well. So, you know, there's the social pressure to stop and eat has been maybe lost.
Yeah, and it's super protective. You know, I certainly have a number of clients who that's really helpful for them, is that left to their own devices, they're just going to work through all day, even though they know they need to stop and eat. And they can piggyback onto the people around them who have like a natural relationship with food. Right? Yeah, and be like, right, yep, every single time that person does it, I'm going to do it. That's going to be my cue. At a certain stage of recovery, that's really helpful. Of course, you want to get to the point where that's not needed, but it can be so protective. Because I think that's the other, when you sort of asked about like across the different lifespans or what's different, what supports people have and who's taking an active role in pushing back against the eating disorder is probably the biggest thing. So if you've got like a little kid, you know, under 12, who is starting to experience stuff, often, you know, parents can step in and be like, no, eating disorder, you are not taking hold. Nope. Yeah. This is what we're doing. I'm stepping in and I will be making sure you eat this amount at this time. And we're sitting here until it's done. And then we're sitting here to make sure I'm sleeping in your room so you don't do sit-ups all night, all this stuff, which we can, you know, help parents do. To be like, no. But that can disappear. And if you're in your 20s, you have it like you're living with your husband, wife, my romantic partner, whatever, you don't want them to be your carer. Like you don't want, like, and so even though they might want to, it's a bit awkward, you might be hiding it. Parents feel like they no longer have control because you're an adolescent, you're like an older adolescent, or you're an adult, your 20s, you've moved out, and so they can see what's happening and they want to, but they don't have permission to. So that, you know, can change. And then I've worked with women whose husbands of 10, 15 years have no idea.
Yeah.
And they kind of know, don't eat much, but they really don't have an idea of the depths of the eating disorder. So I think the thing that can change, you know, and probably the women I work with who are older, just feel so, there's no representation for them.
Around. Yeah, that's right. Like where did
they
go?
They feel like, am I the only person over 70 who has eating disorder? Like, I go to these groups and everyone's younger than me, or my friends don't seem to understand. Like, so I think that support is really different across the different stages, and that level of understanding and just level of feeling, am I a failure because I still have this eating disorder in my 70s? Like, no, of course not. There's so many complexities as to, why it's stuck around.
And the focus, I think the focus of recovery might be a bit different. Like when you're dealing with a pre-adolescent or adolescent, it's really about like trying to, you know, get as much, you know, normal growth and development as possible, and like, you know, as quickly as possible get back.
Got your bone density disorder, your height gait. Like
exactly.
We don't want any stunting. Like there is that pressure there.
Yeah. And so, you know, those markers of recovery, like the return of menstrual cycle, you know, if you're dealing with somebody, you're working with somebody who's like postmenopausal, like how are we defining what is recovered? Like, and it really, you know, it's a different conversation. And it's much more about, not always should be about how the person themselves defines recovery, but, you know, that's going to be very different when you're 12. But, you know, if you're 60, like, you know, and it's living in alignment with your values and, you know, being, you know, like
be flexible,
being honest and not having to look at your shoulder all the time. And so the nuts and bolts are, you know, similar, like, you know, eating regularly, eating enough, eating variety, eating sort of with spontaneity and social, and
trying to manage behaviors and supports and build other things in your toolkit. Because again, at any age, the eating sort of behaviors are often really functional. They are serving a purpose. And I do, you know, and if the purpose, like something we haven't touched on yet, and we won't get into the details of it, but if the origin of someone's eating disorder is trauma, that's going to be very different to someone whose origin is that accidental deficit. And so,
or they wanted to, you know, they started a diet before formal.
That's going to be really different. And so again, really helping the right supports be there, helping the right sort of therapies be there, and just helping reduce shame and secrecy around that. I think the origin, how people sort of ended up, you know, developing an eating disorder is obviously a huge part of their recovery. And that can be, that can be anywhere across the lifespan.
And that is often something, you know, that we would see is that there's a point where, all right, I'm not looking after little children anymore. Mm. Like, I've actually got time and space, and oh, there's all this stuff, you know, and that's when the awareness comes right to the fore. So it is, you know, midlife is often the time where that happens. Like, why am I worried about this now? Why am I, you know, having panic attacks now? Why am I, you know, like, why is this so much more difficult now? And it's a tricky time, I think.
Definitely. And I guess, could you talk a little bit about diet culture and I guess body dissatisfaction when you do age and your body goes through all these changes?
Yes. Yeah, well, that's relentless, right? It's like from, it feels like cradle to grave, really. There is no escaping it, you know. There's, like Meg was saying before about, you know, the body changes that happen, say, with, you know, perimenopause and menopause. If it's happening to most people, is it really pathological? You know, why are we making this like something that should be fixed if it's actually something that the majority of people experience? Like, but it's like, oh, there's this whole market of people that we can target to make them feel terrible about themselves, and then we can sell them stuff. Yoo-hoo.
And the culture's already kind of doing that. So you often hear about the sort of that invisibility that can happen for all people, not just women, but for all as they age, as they get older. And you know, that if your value your whole life has been tied up in how you look or a certain body type, and that's been your visibility, and all of a sudden you're losing that, it's not too far of a stretch to think, well, if I can maintain, you know, the body, we see the Instagram, you know, photos of, you know, older women with still sort of like the inverted commas, like supermodel body, like that's now an aspiration. There's, you know, so that can be so much pressure to try to hang on to that thing that's been so important. And it does probably get harder as you get older, if you're still hanging on to that. I think a lot of people are able to zoom out from it and do the work to be like, oh, that's not actually where my value lies. That's not actually what's important to me. But you have to do the work to do that, because as we were saying right at the beginning, my little oldies I would go and see in the aged care facility, who would still think it would be good for them to lose weight. They've been trying their whole life. And I think, as I say, if you've been trying your whole life and suddenly it's working, you need to see a doctor. Like, there might be something really serious under, like, going on here as well. So I think it's often that diet culture, the story of diet culture is, if you're unhappy with your life,
anything in your life,
you can probably fix by having the thin ideal perfect body that is held up. And the way to attain that is through dieting, whatever name they're going to give dieting.
I remember working, challenge. There's been a few clients I've worked with. So women in their sort of 30s and 40s, like sort of getting to like quite high levels in their career. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're the main earner in the family and, you know, they're looked to as an expert in their field. And they are, you know, finding themselves like self-censored, silenced, because, you know, some like, you know, 20-year-old intern has turned up in, you know, their latest Q outfit in a size 4 or whatever. And that all of the things that are assumed when somebody's in a smaller body of competence, self-control, willpower, all of, you know, like you've got decades of experience and expertise. You've like led teams of professionals. You've got like so many runs on the board, and yet instantaneously that disappears because you're not that size. You know, you're in a, you know, average size body, you know, what, 16 or 18 or 12, 14, whatever, you know, and the complete, like, just everything evaporates. And it's incredible that, you know, and we see it, like, you know, I think magazines are less predominant now, but, you know, throughout sort of like 90s and 2000s, you'd see like really successful women on the cover of a magazine and their latest weight loss story.
Yeah.
You know, and like, you know,
that's the most important, interesting thing about you.
Oprah is probably like the prime, you know, like she's a billionaire, right? And all we ever care about is like, you know, what's her weight doing now? Like, what diet is she on now? What? But I remember there was like a cover with just one really stood out to me. I remember it was Jessica Mowboy. And I think she'd just come out of whatever awards season and she'd won everything. And it was her swelch new look. And you're like, really? Right. Okay. And so we've got this constant, and it's, you know, it's morphed and shifted. And, you know, it used to be, you know, when I was a teenager, it was all the supermodels, right? That was the Christy Turlington and Elle Macpherson and Linda Evangelista and Claudia Schiffer. And they were like, hey, now it's the every kid person next door, everyone's fully like, you know, shredded and their glutes are out and they've got the lips and the fillers and the da 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 da.
And the filters.
But that's right, the filters. And so, like, they don't even, like, I remember, was it Cindy Crawford? I don't even look like Cindy Crawford.
Yeah.
But it's like, now it's everybody.
Mm.
No one looks like they do. You know, I genuinely thought that teenage, this is ridiculous, apparently no one gets acne anymore. Yeah, they do. They just filter it out. So I remember seeing like the kid that lived next door and I was like, oh, wow, you've actually got quite a face full of pimples, you know, fine, whatever. But I was like,
yeah, oh, our reality gets totally distorted.
We know that we're seeing filtered images, and yet our brain still takes them in as the image. Yeah.
Well, even filtered images of yourself, like that research that said, like, if people use those face tuners,
gaslight themselves,
and they will then be dissatisfied with their actual face, even though they did the filtering, they know it's not real.
Yeah.
And it still causes that dissatisfaction. And so I think the what's acceptable keeps getting narrower and narrower and narrower. And it's completely unachievable. Like, even the other day, I think there was a thing like Taylor Swift's now being like, someone's having a go at her for not having enough bum. And you're like, really? Oh. The most successful woman on the planet has to worry about her bum not being perky enough for you?
She needs to go back to the 80s when bums were not in. No one wanted to be bum back then.
Like, it's completely unattainable. It's completely shape-shifting. No individual person can have all of the things. And yet there's still the treadmill factor of trying to.
And it is driven by profit-making entities. Mm. You know, if you feel good in your skin,
you don't buy enough stuff.
You are not buying enough stuff, exactly.
And the collateral damage, you know, really, is like just such so much like distress.
The actual best thing that can happen is you waste your money on a whole lot of stuff.
Mm.
The worst thing is you die.
Yeah.
Like, you know, eating disorders, as we know, are like often fatal.
Mm.
So, you know, for all the kids that just spend, you know, like miserable hours in their room worrying, there's going to be some that just never make it to adulthood, or, you know, never have kids.
Yeah, never have a functional relationship because they like, thought it was just
never achieve taken that the all. Things that they could have. And how often are the people that we see with eating disorders such high achievers?
Mm.
They're so dedicated. They're so smart. They're so good. They've so much to offer. And it's the pressure around bodies and there being this homogenous, just one type, and it shifts throughout, you know, the centuries, but it is just, yeah.
And it doesn't have to be necessarily really super duper explicit messages, but kids are absorbing it. Like just the other day in a group that we're in, this lady shared some photos of she'd gone to like the open school, open night where the kids show their work. And in the subject about PE, one of the pictures a kid had drawn is saying, you know, it's good to just, and she's six, she's in kindy, was like, it's, you know, it's, I love PE. It's good to, if it's so you don't get fat. This is a six-year-old. So those connections around movement being for body control or food for nutrition, or like just that generalized fear of fatness is starting so young. Yeah. And there's the risk that that then leads into really dysfunctional behaviors and just beliefs about your own body, about other people's bodies. So, you know, we can't talk about eating disorders without that backdrop of what's going on with weight stigma and weight bias, because it is the big driving force, like around, but no matter, even if it is, if someone does, you know, enter into eating disorder through trauma, the eating disorder then uses the fear of fatness to keep them stuck there, to focus on that rather than focusing on the other pain or trauma. And it's so frustrating. And we often use it, like sometimes it feels like a toothpick holding back a tsunami against like the diet companies and the pharmaceutical weight loss drugs and bariatric surgeries and Instagram, all of this stuff. But more and more people are pushing back. And so
I think when you've got, you know, you think about, we change the culture, the change in the culture is really changing people, you know. And so, you know, if you are in a household and there are children, that you are intentional about keeping those types of messages out of the house, or if they crop up in media, challenging them immediately. You know, like, I don't know how my kids, you know, we watch Peppa Pig, that's their era, and poor Daddy Pig got shamed all the time. And so like, oh, how do you think that makes Daddy Pig feel? You know, Daddy Pig's a pig. Pigs do have big tummies. Like, that's quite normal, you know. And like, so it was this real that's like one household, and you know, that's not how we talk about bodies. You know, it's people don't like it when you talk about their bodies, good, bad, or indifferent. Like, so let's not. And it's like constant, and touch wood and all of the good luck things. You know, we're doing okay as far as body acceptance in our kids.
And I think when they go out into the world and they hear those really body shame messages, or those real fat is bad, thin is good, all that sort of message, it just doesn't land right with them. They go, or they hear like health, like for my kids will come home and go, teacher told me that oranges have too much sugar in them. And I'm just like, but I told her, actually. Like, okay, well, at least we're, you know, like my body can handle it, or whatever the little phrase was. And so, you know, like that's what we're hoping to do, but we have to be proactive. We are currently working on, I don't know when this podcast is going out, it might be already out, we're sort of working on a program for parents to help them sort of, and we've sort of think about, be the lifeguards. Like, okay, we're checking for danger. We're teaching them to swim. We're making sure they put all their sun cream. We're teaching them not to go to unpatrolled beaches. Like, don't swim in with the sharks. But also, the lifeguard has to be a good swimmer. And so, because we can't do it for them, but we can absolutely be training them up. And it doesn't mean that they won't be caught in a rip ever, and we won't have to call in reinforcements and yoink them out. But let's be like alert.
Give them enough tools to move through the world,
because it's going to be like full of rips and sharks.
Yeah.
Which is really hard, but we're trying to make it less rippy and less sharky.
Yes.
Definitely. And you both were kind of talking about it a bit before, like the prevention and the protection from eating disorders. I guess, could you talk a little bit about how we can kind of do that more throughout the life stages for people?
Yeah. Well, I think it is really a bit like Meg said, you know, having, and I think we just saw, like, was it Claire Gaspar you had on, like diet culture free households? I think that's to have an environment where body acceptance and body respect is the norm. And to do that, you need to have that yourself as an adult. So, you know, if you're creating that environment, and, you know, there needs to have been a, you know, probably a number of conversations between you and, you know, the other parent perhaps. But that we're consistent and authentic. We genuinely, our children never hear us criticizing bodies for their weight, our own or other people's. So that is something I think that, you know, when if people are listening to this, they're going to go, ooh, I've been watching Maths right now and we're talking about all sorts of bodies, whatever. So there might be some real, like, personal work for people to do. But faking it till you make it is a thing as well. So the prevention, again, it's like what happens in the workplace. Do we, you know, allow people to be doing weight loss competitions in a workplace? Mm. No, we shouldn't, you know, and, you know, how we talk about movement, say, like, there's often, like, different challenges. You know, how do people engage with movement? Is it about being stronger, more flexible, more responsive, reactive, limber?
Sleeping better, sleeping go to the toilet better, more regularly.
That's right, exactly.
Lots of positives.
You know, why are we eating vegetables regularly? Is it for diet reasons, or is it because they're crunchy and they're crisp and they're colourful and they're like, you know, some of them are a bit bitter and that's a really great counterpoint to something that's sort of rich and oily like? You know, can we talk about food in a really neutral way? Can we talk about bodies and movement in a really neutral way? Can we mean it?
Yes. And I think in nutrition education can be really a problem. I think there's been some shifts. I don't think they've actually rolled to the classroom level yet, but certainly on a sort of more policy level, some shifts towards let's teach kids without a side of diet culture. Like, let's do, you know, particularly for younger kids, nutrition education should be food education, not about calories or like health risks or this, that, and the other, but like color and texture and where does it come from and how do I cook it and what is it nice with? And actually, you know, food variety is so powerful from a health risk perspective. So it's like enjoy food and have it embraced rather than trying to teach these nuanced
food,
and these
bad foods
and these abstract concepts that kids will distill down to, I shouldn't eat that or I might get fat and fat must be bad. And that's what's been happening. That's, you know, with this little, that little artwork that we saw, that's what's been distilled down for this kid. Whether the message was, you know, whether she's hearing from, I go for my run in the morning so I don't get fat. Who knows where the message is coming from, but it has landed for her as you exercise to not get fat. End of story. That's what I like about PE. Like, that was the distilled down.
Yeah.
And so we're doing we're teaching a whole lot of stuff that then kids are really needing to unlearn before it becomes a massive problem and then negatively impacts their life. And, you know, some kids, yes, they will develop life-threatening eating disorders, but there's a whole lot of unmeasurable costs for the people who perhaps they don't develop the eating disorder.
Just got that sort of subclinical.
That constant sort of negativity in their head and that constant not feeling comfortable in their body, not trusting their body.
Don't want to go on the swimming carnival, don't want to be on the debating team, don't want to put myself forward because
look at me. So there's a lot of, I think, those sort of unmeasurables as well, where it actually does harm people's lives. It might not take over their whole life and require a period of time where every bit of focus is about eating sort of recovery, but it can still really make people's life smaller.
So I think that, like, conversations that are about who you are, you know, not like what you look like as well. And that's across the whole age spectrum, you know, like, it's the most bog standard compliment. Oh my gosh, you look amazing. Have you lost weight? You know, how hard would it be to just go, oh, it's so nice to see you. I always feel good after we've spent time together. Like, that's nice, regardless of, you know, what shape I happen to be occupying at this moment in my life. And that is, you know, when we really think about, you know, the people, and, you know, we talk a lot in the work we do about values, what matters to us in the relationships that we have. And it, people aren't choosing their friends because of their dress size. They're, you know, like, it's because they're funny or they're honest or they're, you know,
kind
they're
compassionate.
Exactly.
And generous. And yeah.
So those sorts of, like, normalizing those kinds of conversations, you know, what is it about you that, like, I really appreciate? Because we can do more of that. We can be kinder. We can be funnier, or maybe, you know, we have some agency over those things. Like, what our body looks like that's guaranteed to change throughout mm-hmm. our lifespan. You know, like if there's one thing that is guaranteed, it is change, you know. So trying to hold ourselves paused in time is just it's such a misery and it's such a waste of energy. But yeah, so, you know, being really, you know, I think with when we're with children, like, again, it's like, I guess, praising their effort. You know, I saw how hard you tried with that. That was, you know, gosh, I could see that you were getting a bit sort of frustrated and then you pushed through. That was great. Rather than, you know, oh, that's
you're
you know,
so smart.
You're so smart. Yeah. Or, I think really trying to encourage more of what we want to see, but also more of what we can actually do. You know, persistence and perseverance and problem solving and that sort of thing. Because a bit like praising intelligence, it's really ephemeral. Like, how do I
and it's a significant genetic blueprint bit to it that you probably can't take credit for or be blamed for.
That's right. So, but yeah, you know, I think the one of the tools that we've used, and we've run it as like a sort of like challenge or webinar, and it's something we do in the course, is that diet culture spring clean. Let's walk through our environment looking for where does it show up. You know, what are our recipe books look like? Are they Weight Watchers recipe books? You know, do you walk into the bathroom and get hit in the face with a set of scales? You know, like, so where are those
in your social space, in your relationships? Like, if you might be trying to have a sort of a, you know, diet culture free home, but grandma or grandpa come over and say, you've got to eat everything on your plate.
Yeah,
or is that too much for you?
I'm going to lose weight going up and down these stairs.
Yeah.
Nah.
So again, and you know, sort of helping resource people to
how do you have that?
You know, figure out whether to have the conversation and how to have it and what their boundaries are going to be around that.
Do you run interference instead?
Or do you have the debrief after they leave? So, because there are different options, it's not always going to be exactly the same situation. So there's a lot we can do. I think that, you know, it's really easy to talk to us and we get this like, oh, it's everything's so the worst. But there's a lot we can do. And we certainly have, you know, a lot of success stories with, you know, people not passing on to their kids what they grew up with, and doing something really intentionally different and seeing the benefits of that. So on an optimistic note, there is a lot that can do, and we do see improvements, and you know, people recover when they thought they weren't ever going to, to what the recovery is going to be for them. We're optimistic. We get frustrated and we get down, but then we just remember there is a lot that we can do to make places safer.
Yes, and there's so much joy in each life stage when you do value food, you know, family. It's a big thing. And to be cook.
Even perimenopause, because that sort of reduction in estrogen, you care a lot less about what people think. Just saying.
Well, for anyone who would like to find more information about you guys, where could they find you?
Yeah, so the best place is probably our website. So it's megandsusan.co. And you can sign up for our weekly newsletter. We just sort of send out a link to our podcast and what we're doing. If there's something sort of in the news that week, we'll try to talk about our thoughts on that. There's our podcast, Life's Too Short to Count Almonds. And then we're just Meg and Susan on all the social media stuff, Instagram and
Facebook.
Sort of
TikTok.
But sort of not.
But a little bit.
Susan does all our social media. I'm not.
Yeah. I do rely on my teenagers to, can you tell me how to make this work on TikTok? Because my stuff just dive bombs and they get the, when they play around with it, they get the views and
that's so funny.
Yeah. Anyway.
Well, I love to see that you're both on TikTok.
It's
it's our combined one.
It's intermittent.
It's very, yes. It's where the old people are. We're on Instagram.
That's what I heard. You know, it's so fun.
I know. It's like, just got to get out of your own way and do it, right? Anyway, yeah.
I wanted to say thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. It has been wonderful.
Thank you so much for having us.
It's been a lovely chat.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, that's the end of today's episode. Please subscribe, leave us a comment or a review. If you would also like to learn more about Body Matters services, you can check out our website at bodymatters.com.au. Thanks for listening.